Good morning and welcome to Local Matters. I am your host, Michael Detweiler. Today, I have none other than District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway on the show. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, for the folks who don't know you, give us some background on Bryant Dunaway. Where was he born? Where did he go to school? All that fun stuff.
Well, that's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to make it as brief as I can. So, I was born in Crossville, which is just a few miles down the road. Mom and Dad both grew up in Crossville, but I didn't really, I can't claim it as home really because I didn't grow up there and do all my schooling there. So, about the time second grade rolled around, my mother and I, my parents had divorced, and my mother and I moved to Miami, Florida. So, Miami, Florida is where I spent the second grade and through high school, and did my schooling there. So, while I was born in Crossville and its original hometown, and a lot of family still there, I did my high school years and middle school years and most of elementary school in Miami, Florida.
In Miami, Florida.
Which was a big, lot different than Middle Tennessee.
I can imagine. Yeah. I was going to ask you that. Was it kind of a culture shock to go from Crossville to Miami, Florida?
Well, you didn't notice it so much when you were a second grader.
Sure.
But, and I was glad to grow up there. It was a neat experience, very diverse. Still keep in touch with a lot of people there. But I wouldn't want to raise my kids there. I'm happy to be here in Cookeville, Putnam County, Upper Cumberland area. It's my home.
And that's
where I want to be and have raised my children here.
That's interesting. Yeah. So second grade, you moved from Crossville to Miami, Florida. A mutual friend of ours, Bill Lose, is from down there. In South Florida. He and I have had a lot of chats about Broward County.
Right. That's just north of where I grew up. Broward County is where Fort Lauderdale is.
Yes.
And I grew up in Dade County, just south of that.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
That's interesting.
And interesting, one of my high school classmates I graduated from North Miami Senior High School with is a guy named Dave Ehrenberg, and he's the elected state attorney in Palm Beach County.
Wow.
So we both ended up being elected prosecutors in different parts of the country.
So as you were going through high school, did being an attorney, was that on your radar screen?
Never entered my mind.
Never entered your mind?
No. So my goal growing up was, was always in. My dad was kind of in law enforcement. He was a military policeman in the military, and when he retired from the military, still remained in law enforcement in Tennessee. And that's kind of what my goal was. As I went through college, attended Tennessee Tech, criminal justice major, and had every intent to get into law enforcement. And I did right out of college. Took my first job out of Tennessee Tech after graduating was a police officer with the Cookeville Police Department. And I spent a few years there. And then while I was a police officer with the Cookeville Police Department, I had decided to go to law school. So it wasn't until a few years out of college that I decided to make a change and to go a different direction. But before that, I would have never entered my mind, really.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So your father, you said, was in law enforcement, starting, as an MP and then ending up in law enforcement here. So then I would imagine that you would, spend summers with him, come back.
I
up
did,
here to
yeah.
Tennessee.
Well, and my dad was a career military guy for a long time, so he was all over the place, and I spent time with him. He was stationed in various places: West Point, New York,
okay,
Fort Rucker, Alabama. Different places. Yeah, I'd spent time with Dad, but he retired from the Army, and then he had originally grown up in Crossville, and when he retired, he came back to Crossville, and that's where he lives today. And he, after his military career, he got a job with the Tennessee Department of Corrections and was an investigator for them for many years. And now he's fully retired and mowing grass and tinkering with four-wheelers.
I love it. That sounds like a great life.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm jealous of this guy.
I am too.
So you out of high school, you head to Tennessee Tech.
I did. I went one semester of college in Miami and then decided, I just wanted to change the scenery. And a dad had actually told me about this little school called Tennessee Tech that was about 50 miles from his house. And I thought, never heard of it. Let's do it. So back then, you applied. Everything was on paper. There was no internet. Michael, the world's changed.
Yeah.
So I applied for Tennessee Tech and was accepted and packed everything up I owned in a car and headed Miami and rolled into Cookeville in 1989.
And, how about that?
And I thought, well, what have I done?
Because
that was a culture shock.
Right. Going as a coming out of high school and then coming here from Miami.
Right.
I can imagine.
And back then,
shock.
If you can imagine, some of your listeners may, Restaurant Row was like a cow pasture. There was three places to eat then, Western Sizzlin', Quincy's, and that was about it.
Yes. Yes.
And Shoney's.
I had a long career at Quincy's, so I completely understand.
Remember the yeast rolls well.
That's right. That's right. So you joined the Cookeville Police Department. I can imagine policing at that time is probably different than it is today.
Well, it is. It was a transition. I was a police officer with Cookeville in the early 90s. And in fact, I left in 1996. So it was, you know, or the early 90s when I was there. And while I was there, you know, there were no computers in cars back then, you know, but while I was an officer, we got our first in-car cameras. While I was there, and I got one of those first ones. And back then, the in-car cameras were recording on VHS videotapes. So that's, even with that, the technology, it's amazing how the technology has changed in the last 30 years. It's unbelievable.
And I guess for chiefs and for council people and the city manager, you know, you have to budget for these changes that coming at you.
Well, today, we'll just take the Cookeville Police Department today. Every police officer is running four cameras that are recording. They have a body camera on their person, and they have three cameras on their car, you know, front, back, and in the back seat, and which all create footage. So, you know, you got to store that stuff someplace. So, technology, while it has a lot of conveniences, it does present its own challenges with storage and just all kinds of issues.
Sure. And yeah. I imagine the city and police department themselves have to have IT people.
Though they do.
To be able to keep this all running for
personnel positions that never needed to be existed before we got into the internet age.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So everybody's got IT people now.
Supposed to make everything better, but then it creates more positions.
That's right.
I would assume that in your office today, IT things are a lot larger than they were your predecessor.
I've been the DA. I was elected in 2014, and so this is, about to begin my seventh year. And even in those 7 years, technology has advanced a lot. We now have, we use cloud-based systems that we didn't when I was elected, which is amazing. We deliver what we call discovery. And, you know, when we litigate cases, we provide the defense attorneys with, the file and the investigative content. And we do that through a cloud-based system now, which we implemented since I've been the DA, and which is very convenient and useful, but everybody's come to like it that way. And we're not dealing with paper and burning CDs and all that anymore.
Right.
So there's pros and cons to technology,
sure,
but
sure.
It certainly is, it's changing all the time.
You're not sending out 90-page faxes to places.
Yeah,
right?
Faxes. It's almost frustrating now when people even send a fax. Who sends a fax anymore?
Right exactly.
Yeah.
In my regular 8-to-5 job, we have something that's an e-fax, and so we get tons of paper through the electronic fax.
Sure.
That comes through
the
computer.
That's right.
So in the medical field, we still have to have that, which is unbelievable. So, you decide at some point after leaving the police department or before you left the police department that, hey, I like law enforcement, but I'd like to become an attorney. How did that all happen?
Well, I was as a police officer, I was, make criminal cases and arrest people, and that would require me to be in court. And honestly, I just started, I saw some attorneys doing their work in the courtroom and it intrigued me. And I thought, that's something that really does intrigue me. So I applied to law school and got accepted and began to go to law school while I was still a police officer. And then, finished up my studies, my legal studies, passed the bar exam and then began a private practice. I had my own law office, had a couple of law partners for several years, and then went into practice on my own for many years. And then about 2013, I had several community, some people from the community come to me and say, well, there's election year coming up. Why don't you consider running for district attorney? And honestly, it hadn't occurred to me at that point. And I thought, my practice is doing good. Life as well. But once that seed was planted, it just kept eating at me. Finally, I told my wife, I said, I think kind of God's trying to tell me something here, And so I really thought and pondered over it. And then once my wife, when I explained to her what all would be involved in running in a 7-county race, and she accepted that and was all in, well, you know, she was the one I had to get, was all in for that.
You're absolutely right.
Then the, you know, I gave myself a deadline and decided and made my announcement. And thankfully I ran a primary race that year and a general election race and was successful. And, since September 1st of 14, I've served in the role of district attorney general and look forward to running again this next term.
That's great. Well, I hope you do. I hope you do. So, hey, an official announcement here.
Well.
So, folks, if you're just joining us, the voice you're hearing is District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway. I remember being in your law office and seeing your cool stand-up desk. So do you still have that?
I still have the stand-up desk.
Awesome.
Yes. I do have a normal desk in my office. I say normal, the one you would sit at. But I have a stand-up desk, the same one you remember, my office. In fact, I own three of them.
Do you?
I've got several of them in my offices. You know, I work at my stand-up desk quite often. And I work at the sit-down one too, but you know, I just a habit I got into years ago. I enjoy it. You know, I just don't like sitting all day. So,
well, I think it's better on your back.
It is.
If you're standing and working as opposed to sitting and working, because it can really affect your lower back. And so, I mean, I want a stand up desk as well. So what I have to do now is get rid of my current setup because my wife says, you're not getting another desk unless you get rid of the current one.
Well, I've got the bug now. So now I look for them. I like antiques as well.
Sure.
So I look for them on,
eBay,
different places like that. And I've found two others since
good
the one you've seen and I've bought them and I use them in two of my other offices as well.
Well, that's awesome. Well, hey, when we come back after the break, join us to listen to District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway.
What's so important about shopping with locally owned businesses?
When you shop local, your hard-earned dollars stay here in the community, helping to benefit your friends and neighbors, local schools, roads, and all aspects of community life.
But what happens to my money if I spend it online or at a national chain store?
In most cases, the profits go far away, out of state, corporate headquarters, or even overseas.
It doesn't take any extra effort to shop local. OfficeMart on South Jefferson and Cookeville is your locally owned office furniture and supply store. For over 35 years, they've been proud to serve businesses in the Upper Cumberland with quality and value. You get real customer service, too. And unlike shopping online, you can actually see and try out the large inventory of office furniture in their showroom. And when it's delivered, it's not a box on your step. They're glad to install and set up everything. OfficeMart. There's no other locally owned office store in the region. South Jefferson Avenue across from Hardee's. Shop local at OfficeMart.
Good morning and welcome back to Local Matters. I'm with District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway. And again, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. In the previous segment, we were talking about early life and going to Tennessee Tech and then going to law school. You were a Cookeville police officer. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your family.
Oh, man, that's the most thing I'm most proud of and the role that I'm most cherish, I suppose, that a father and husband. So I'm married to Leanne, my wife. She is a nurse at Cookeville Regional Medical Center. She went to Tennessee Tech, nursing school graduate there. And her first job out of nursing school was in the ER at the Cookeville Regional Medical Center. And it was Cookeville General Hospital back then.
Yes, it was.
And so she's been there 28 years. And she told me the other day she's going to retire in two. So it's hard to believe that we're thinking even about things like that. But we actually met in college. We were students we overlapped a little bit at Tennessee Tech, but we didn't date then. We started dating when she was working as a nurse in the ER and I was a Cookeville police officer. And, I actually arrested a guy who was causing a disturbance in the ER. And that's what brought us to talking and reconnecting. And that's kind of the beginning of the story. And that's been, I guess we're in our 26th year of marriage now.
That's amazing.
It is. It's great. And we have three wonderful children. We have twin daughters, identical twin daughters, Katie and Julianne, and they are graduates of Cookeville High School and just finished their first year of college and, have just moved back home for the summer. They'll be 19 this year. And actually they're 19 now. They'll be 20 this year. It's hard to keep track. And then we have a son who's a just finished his freshman year at the Cookeville High School. He'll be a sophomore in the fall.
Is he a freshman?
He's about to be a sophomore.
Are
yeah.
you kidding
so
me?
So he's 15. Our son's name's Grant. And so we have three. And he wouldn't admit it, but he's kind of missed his sister since they've been off to college. But Julianne is a student at ETSU in Johnson City, studying dental hygiene. And Katie stayed here at Tennessee Tech, and she's an education major. But I made them both move out. Katie stayed in the dorms at Tennessee Tech this fall, and they're both looking forward to having apartments as college students this fall.
So this is the first time they've been apart from each other.
Well, yeah, it has been. When they went off to college last fall, it was the first time in their lives that they'd not been, you know, with each other every day of their lives. And that's a question I'm often asked. You know, it's unique to parent identical twins. It's been an adventure these 20 years. But as far as them splitting up, we were kind of observing about how they would take it and how they would react to it. But in a weird way, they talk to each other every day. But I think they've enjoyed being apart a little bit. If there's a hindrance about being a twin, everybody compares them to each other.
Sure.
Right? You know, as identical twins. And they've enjoyed, I think, a little bit of their individuality. And their whole lives they've had to share everything, you know, and now they've had their own stuff and they don't have to share so much. And it's been kind of fun for them, I think.
That's neat. So did when they were younger or even as they're, you know, teens and everything else, did people mix them up?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they absolutely did. And when they were really young, especially when they were really young, they dressed the same, you know, typical twins did. But it was funny. I remember back, they were probably in the third grade. They came home one day and they told Leanne and I, they said, you know, we don't want to dress like twins anymore, just on their own. So they, on their own and made their own decision, they weren't going to dress the same every day to school.
That's
you know,
great.
They started wearing their own thing. And even though they look very much alike and are identical twins, their personalities are completely opposite.
Are they?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So
yeah, truly individuals.
So is one more like you and one's more like your wife?
Absolutely. Okay. They are. Yeah. Julianne's wired much more like my wife is, and Katie's wired more like I am. You know, as far as personality wise.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, we got to, as a family, you know, we attended, you know, quite a few of the high school basketball games.
Oh, yeah.
And it was fun watching.
Yeah. The girls played basketball, you know, sports all growing up or, you know, played on varsity basketball 4 years at Cookeville High School and enjoyed it. They really loved it. We miss that. We still attend the basketball games because we enjoy it and watch the other ladies that they played with. They're a year or two behind them. We can continue to watch them play.
That's
we
great.
Enjoy that.
Yeah, it is. Our son plays soccer and our daughter plays tennis. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not, you know, running to soccer practice or on the weekends going to games, you know, we've got tennis matches.
Oh, yeah.
And then my daughter likes to practice. So my old body's out there running on the hard court chasing tennis balls. So I get all that. My guest today is District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway. We're enjoying talking about family. How do you separate being the district attorney? Like, I know things come across your desk that are extremely difficult. How do you put that on the back burner when you leave?
Well, sometimes it's hard. You know, I don't talk about work issues at home very much, and my wife is savvy enough to really not ask about them. You know, there's some topics that you just kind of like to leave at the office. You know, in the work that we do, you know, nobody's surprised that there's a drug issue. You know,
sure.
We all know there's drug problems in our community, in every community, and that's not a big surprise. And we all know violent crime happens, and you know, while it's terrible, it's not shocking when something happens to, you know, but for the public, the general public, what would shock everyone's conscience if they really realize, and what's been most surprising to me since I've been DA is the volume of child sexual abuse that is present in our communities. So much so, just to give you an example, I have, well, including myself, there are 17 lawyers in my office, 17 prosecutors. I've assigned two of them. All those two prosecutors do is handle child sex abuse cases. So I have two full-time lawyers, and that's the only kind of cases they handle. So if that gives you any idea of what the volume of that type of case is.
And one small district in one state.
That's right.
In this country.
That's right. And you know, and when I say child sex abuse, I mean, I'm talking about the ugly stuff, you know, the The sexual offenses against kids, rape of children, you know, child pornography. It's all here in our community. And, you know, thankfully most of us aren't exposed to it, but it's here, and it's here in a large volume.
Are those cases predominantly, or I don't even know if you can answer this. If you can't, that's okay. Are a lot of those cases the child knew who the person was?
Absolutely. The stereotype of the creepy looking guy driving through the neighborhood,
the white panel van,
you know, that's really not how things happen. So if you looked at all of the cases we have and the offenders, they fit into this description. There's somebody that is in a position of trust.
Mm-hmm.
They are a family member, somebody who's known at church, a teacher or a coach, or, you know, and I'm not all the teachers and coaches out there. You know, I've got lots of them, but you know, my point is they're people who are in positions of trust that a parent would ordinarily and not blink about trusting them. And they're also people who have the opportunity to be exposed and be around children. And so, you know, it's the perfect storm. Those are the, when you read about in the paper, take note, you'll see that the offenders for these types of crimes are usually in
a position of
trust, family member, or somebody who works with children or has access to children.
And repeat that statistic. You have two full-time.
I have two attorneys on my staff handle child sex abuse cases exclusively full-time.
Right. That's unbelievable.
And then I have two investigators on my staff as well, and that is the bulk of their caseload as well, is that type of case.
As a dad, that just, yes. I mean, that just hits me between the eyes.
Well, and when you ask your original question of what you take home, you know, when you come home and you look at your own children, those are the types of cases that are difficult sometimes. Sometimes you want to go home and just hug your kids, right?
Sure.
Because you've seen the terrible instances and circumstances and environments that some children are burdened with, and it just breaks your heart. Mm. And so you're thankful and appreciative of your own family.
When we come back, we'll have our third and final segment with District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway here on Local Matters. We're back here on Local Matters with District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway. So we were talking as we went to the break about those cases that are so difficult that it's hard not to take it home. And I think what you talked about with the child sex abuse cases, the volume of cases and staff it takes to manage those, that's just an incredible number. Obviously, we have a huge drug issue. Also, as you read the paper and you look on mugshots and different things like that, you see a lot of the cases involved alcohol-related offenses as well.
Well, yeah, we still have alcohol-related offenses. But if I can give you just the drug problem has always been present, and for decades, and we talked about it at the break. But as long as there's a demand for an impairing substance, it's going to be a constant battle. But it ebbs and flows. The drug dynamics ebbs and flows, and there's lots of things that change that. And one of the things and observations we've made over the last several years is we don't see as much alcohol anymore. Let's just take impaired driving or DUI, for example. Used to be that most of your impaired driving cases were alcohol related, you know, in years past. And that's no longer the case. I would say around 30% are alcohol related. And so the rest of them are drug related.
Wow.
And when I say drug related, that's a broad sweep. That would include illicit drugs like methamphetamine, heroin, and also the abuse of prescription medications, opiates, and things like that. So, and often we see when toxicology results are returned to us from the TBI crime lab, we see sometimes a combination of alcohol and drugs, but more often you see the absence of alcohol and the presence of drugs. That's the most prevalent scenario we have now when it comes to impaired driving cases.
So is it a mixture of, say, like prescription, say, opiates and methamphetamine?
Yes.
Is that?
Often, yes.
Okay.
You know, last year we tried a vehicular homicide I did in Overton County, our neighbor to the north, where it was just that. It was a combination of pills and methamphetamine. a couple of weeks ago. I had a case, vehicular homicide case there for trial, and the defendant ended up pleading, so we didn't have to try the case. But it was a combination of high levels of prescribed opiates in combination with methamphetamine. So that's quite often we see the case with that. We have methamphetamine is probably the biggest scourge that we have right now in our community. It's enormous problem.
And this is the methamphetamine that's not being made in the backs of cars anymore. This is coming up from our south.
That's
correct?
Right. You know, the criminals, they change course when headway is made. To give you an example, I mentioned a minute ago that I was a police officer in the early 90s here. In the early 90s, if you would have told me methamphetamine, I wouldn't have known what you're talking about. It wasn't here. We didn't know what methamphetamine was. We didn't have a problem with it here in the early 90s. By the late 90s, it was a huge problem. But the methamphetamine we dealt with was being made here in methamphetamine labs, in shake and bake operations and car trunks and sheds and backyards and, you know, everywhere it was produced here. Well, the legislature addressed that, and the legislature passed some legislation that was helpful when we started keeping track of Sudafed. And so that put a dent in that operation, didn't eliminate it completely, but it put a dent in it. So now, fast forward to today, we don't have labs around anymore. It's a rarity that we find a meth lab locally, but the methamphetamine is coming in from south of the border, and from Mexico across the border and trafficked through Atlanta and on up through here. And the methamphetamine that we deal with today is much more pure than the methamphetamine made in local labs like it was in the past. And it's just, we're a customer base now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't produce it locally. We just buy it. I mean, it's everywhere.
And do you think, again, as far as users go, do the users span all socioeconomic classes?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, obviously it's affecting all socioeconomic classes because of break-ins, because of,
sure,
you know, on and on and on. But so users come across a wide spectrum.
They do. Yeah, we have. Yeah, methamphetamine is affected families, from people who are of meager means to professionals. I mean, it's a tough drug because once you get on it, it's really hard to beat. It's really hard to beat the addiction, the treatment for it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a constant challenge. So also the other ebb and flow with drugs is now we're seeing, like we never did before, drugs like heroin and fentanyl. Mm-hmm. In our communities. And, you know, the danger with fentanyl is it just a microgram. To give you a visual of a microgram, it's like a grain of salt. You know, a microgram will kill you with fentanyl. That much of fentanyl will kill you. And we've had lots of overdose deaths related to fentanyl, in our area.
So in an overdose death in that situation, would have that person known that the fentanyl was in it, or is it fentanyl laced?
Sometimes both.
Really?
So there are some deaths related to, you know, a person might be intending to ingest cocaine, but they unknowingly it's mixed or compounded with fentanyl, and that's what's killed them. But we also have people that have such an addiction they seek out fentanyl because it provides such a good high. I'm told. I've never tried it myself, but it can kill you, and it's also a danger to law enforcement and EMS workers who may be exposed to it because, you know, you can absorb fentanyl through your skin transdermally, and that's a danger, you know, if you happen to just inadvertently touch it when you're dealing with somebody in the public. So it's a concern across the board, but we're dealing with, you know, and heroin too. It's here.
Which is hard to believe.
Yeah,
you know?
It is. But it's just a constant battle, and the drug, the battle with drugs is constantly changing and ebb and flowing. As I've given you some examples today.
Not necessarily your opinion, but would, and I'm not advocating for any of this, so I'll put that caveat out there before I ask the question, but I got to ask the question. Would legalizing any of this stuff make a difference?
Well, I'm not an advocate for legalizing illicit drugs, and I assume, you know, there's an effort and a discussion nationwide about marijuana.
Sure.
We just have to address the elephant in the room. I'm not an advocate for legalizing marijuana, especially recreational marijuana. There's one reason to smoke marijuana, and it's to get high. Yeah. And it is impairing, and it's quickly impairing. And, you know, we've seen statistics from other states who have done it, and the impaired driving cases have gone up, and there's all kinds of problems. You know, the whole another issue is medical marijuana. What I would like to see is, hey, let's, you know, I'm not a medical doctor. I'd like to see the FDA vet that drug for and determine that it is a legitimate use for a medical purpose.
Of course.
And we haven't seen that yet.
Right.
Like we have with every other substance. And so, you know, I wouldn't be for medical marijuana either until that happens. And then I'd reevaluate. But certainly I'm opposed to recreational legalization of that. I think there are some people who don't do things because they're illegal. And if they were legal, they might do them. You know, there's a public safety element to everything that the opinions that I form and the way I look at things. And I think that would create a larger public safety issue for our communities.
So you'd like to continue doing this job?
I would. Yes. Okay. I do. I enjoyed practicing law in private practice. It was good to me. Since I've been elected DA, I've really, found a job that just really suits me. You know, this is something that I have a passion for. I have a great team. I've got 53 total employees with 16 attorneys who work for me, and they do a great job. Everybody's got the right heart. Their heart's in the right place to accomplish justice and mercy when it's appropriate, and have a good relationship with our local law enforcement partners, our sheriffs and police chiefs, and everybody works really well together in a team here, and our local judges the same way. You know, I hear a few horror stories from my colleagues, other DAs in the state, where they have contentious relationships with some of their judges and stuff. And we just don't have that here. Our community in the Upper Cumberland really works well together.
And not to put you on the spot, but the seven counties that you represent.
So the 13th Judicial District is the largest in the state.
Okay.
No other district has seven counties. And so my counties of the 13th District are Clay, Pickett, Overton, Putnam, Cumberland, White, and DeKalb.
You know, when I got asked that question when I worked for Congressman Black, I kind of had to go, you know, like I was visualizing a map and read around.
Well,
the
congressional district is much more than seven. It was like 15 or 16,
it was,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, 15 counties. But I worked in seven of them, and it was the same seven that you work in as well. And I want to say to you, thank you for your fight at the parole board.
Oh,
when you.
You
go and speak on behalf of victims' families.
Yeah, so I personally, if I'm at all able, you know, we have people who have been convicted of murder from our district, and they come up for parole from time to time because they were sentenced under the old law. And I try to personally attend those and speak for the victims. Sometimes we have family members who are still around and able to speak for their family, but many of those parole hearings, I'm sitting there by myself because, you know, there's no family left of that person who's been murdered. And, you know, I think somebody needs to sit there with them. You know, I'll always remember this, the murder case that is the oldest one that I've attended a parole hearing, it happened in 1968 in Cumberland County. So we're still, you know, trying to be a voice for victims even long after the trial and conviction.
Well, I just wanted to thank you personally for
doing that.
Because when media shines the light on the fact that you're doing that, I'm telling you, people notice.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
It's a big deal.
Well, and I take it personally as an opportunity to remember the victim. You know, people tend to have short memories, and you know, when years pass and somebody's been murdered, it's always nice to take a few minutes and remember the victim. And I think their families appreciate that.
Well, thank you for being on the show today. I sincerely appreciate you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was District Attorney General Bryant Dunaway, and you are listening to Local Matters.